Hello, and welcome to Occupied Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. I'm Rania Batrice, a non-resident fellow at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. And today is Wednesday, May 1st. I'm so excited to be here with my dear friend, Mary Anais Hegler. Many of you out there are already familiar with Mary, but just in case, Mary's a climate justice writer and an essayist, truly one of the most talented and impactful writers of our time. And I'm so honored that she's with us today. In her writing, Mary makes the existential threat that is climate change and the rise in climate injustice accessible and intriguing while reminding us that we all have a part to play. It's not easy to do, and it's truly one of just why she's one of my very favorite writers. I feel like you don't always believe me when I say that, but it's true.
I'm just saying.
We could really just spend an entire, several episodes actually on just your work and how it's, why it's so incredible. But we're going to focus in on Palestine today. And obviously conversations you and I have on a daily basis that I think are important to put out into the world. So we're just going to, we're going to get right into it. And this is, we are dear friends, so this might be even a little more conversational than usual, but I think what we're bringing forward here today is really important. So I want to just first start with something I'm very excited about. You have a new novel coming out the first week of May. It's called Troubled Waters, and just a quick description of the novel, and I'm gonna read it because I don't want to get it wrong. I mean, I have all my personal thoughts, but this is the official description. In this intimate portrait of two generations, a granddaughter and grandmother come to terms with what it means to be family, Black women, and alive in a world on fire. We're putting a link in the show notes, so please check it out for sure. It's really incredible, and not just because I'm biased. Truly, truly incredible.
Rania has actually read it.
I have actually read it. Yes, so yeah. I'm not just guessing here. It's not like a, and I couldn't put it down. I said this to Mary. I'm just going to share a little point of privilege. Mary said, are you just saying this because we're friends? I was like, listen, we're friends and I love you, but I would have eventually finished it. The speed in which I finished this novel was truly because I could not put it down. So again, I don't want to give too much away, but there is a part in the novel where you reference Palestine. And I think it's kind of the perfect entree into our conversation because it does kind of give a snapshot into the intersection of movement spaces, including what we're seeing happening right now. So I just want to, I want you to tell us why you made this decision to insert, even in the short scene, it's still pretty impactful. It's a short scene, but it's impactful, into your storyline. And why is it important for you to engage with Palestine in your novel? What was the goal? What was the intention?
Yeah, so it shows up in the novel because my main character, Corinne, is in the process of becoming radicalized about climate change and wants to do something big and risky. And she is advised to go to a nonviolent direct action training. And she kind of walks into that training feeling like, I am tackling climate change. I am tackling the existential threat, the biggest thing on the planet, because it's literally the planet. And I stand on the shoulders of, you know, my, she knows a little bit of her family's history with civil rights. She doesn't know enough or all of it, which is part of the tension of the book. But she knows that she stands on those sorts of shoulders as a, even just simply as a Black woman from Mississippi. So she's kind of walking in kind of cocky. And I wanted her to kind of be humbled in that. And so she is paired off with someone who is a Palestinian rights activist. He, I don't think this registers to her at the moment, but he is like, you know, he's working on land back, whether he knows it or not, or whether she realizes it or not, because that is a lot of what Free Palestine is about. It's about giving land back to the indigenous people who are Palestinians, which is a climate solution. But I don't think the characters are really realizing that in the moment. But I wanted her to be confronted with like, oh no, I actually can learn something from this person and these people. And I am not the only one who has the world on my shoulders. So that was my thinking and intention behind that. And I think, you know, I wonder if people will read it and think, oh, this was like a reaction to what's happening in Gaza, but I wrote it before that.
Yes, I can attest to that as
Yeah.
well. And I do think it is the way in which you insert and even how you're talking about it now, I do think is such a reminder to all of us, because we often, let's be honest, like movement spaces can feel very lonely and they're traumatic by nature. And it is easy to sort of get caught in this place of like, if I am alone, I am on this island. Nobody understands, like all these sorts of things. And the reality is, when we talk, and intersectionality is such a buzzword, but when we talk about intersectionality and the, you know, essence of what that means, I feel like it shows up in that scene. And then it's just such a beautiful reminder to all of us across so many movement spaces that our struggles are like beautifully and perfectly intertwined. Whether or not we want to admit it in a moment, they just are. So,
It's like undoing divide and conquer. Because, and also a way of, I prefer the term holistic over intersectional because it's like intersectional just sounds so technical, first of all. But holistic, it sounds more like healing to me. Right? It's like treating the disease as opposed to the symptoms. And so once you like peel it off, like this colonialism, all of these other things, they are all sort of symptoms of a similar problem that if we're solving for one, we're solving for the other. So like I often meet people who are like, I don't really know what to do about climate change. And then like I talk to them about what they're doing in their life and they're working on things like prison abolition. Well, that's a climate solution. You can just make it more in, you know, intentional. You can be more vocal about the climate connections to that and learn more about how climate connects to the thing that you're already working on. And then it becomes less overwhelming in a way.
No, absolutely. It's such a great point. We're actually going to dive into that a little bit more in a second, but I like that idea of holistic, not being so technical and all of those things. So it makes sense. If we're talking about holistic, I'm going to say holistic instead of intersectional. Where and how and why is Palestine part of your movement vision? And you've talked about it a little bit, but where do you see the struggle for freedom and sovereignty and a just peace in the broader context of justice struggles that aren't necessarily just Palestine?
I feel like Palestine has to be central. It's such an interesting is a terrible way to put it, but it's fascinating in a horrifying kind of way how you see both the past, the future, and the present colliding in Palestine, right? Like we talk about colonialism being a cause of climate change, but we talk about it in this like centuries past type of way. Whereas in Palestine, it is happening right this very minute. The settlers and the just, colonialism and extraction, the way that it was happening in many places in like the early 1900s or 1800s, that wave is happening in Palestine right this minute. At the same time, we talk about climate change being the outcome of colonialism. Well, you have like the early days of colonialism and climate change happening at the exact same time in Palestine, plus neocolonialism happening at the same time in terms of like stealing of resources and things like that. You have like, you have like the genocide of like if the Nazis had the firepower that Israel has right now, if they had the technology that Israel has right now, then that's kind of what we would be looking at. So you're seeing all these like historic things, but mixed with today's technology and how all of those things have marinated over time happening at the exact same time. So it feels like solving for Palestine can solve for so many other problems at the same time and set a precedent. And I think it's like a free Palestine could free us all. And also the consequences of turning a blind eye to it, because it's not a new problem. This problem is as old as my mama, who is, oldish for a woman, but very young for a country. Just taking all of those things into account, Free Palestine, I think, has to be central. And I've also, just really been struck by every time I talk to a Palestinian about their vision of a free Palestine, it's like, we could farm again, we could grow olives again, right? Like they want to do regenerative agriculture. The way that their folks have been doing it since forever, right? Like they just want to be with the land, and be one with it. And like that is environmentalism. We just don't call it that. Like I think I read something recently. I believe it was Edward Said, but it was one of the older, very well-respected Palestinian thinkers. And he was like, environmentalism is like a cause for the weak. And I was like, I see why you think that. Because people frame environmentalism as though it is like charity work, right? Like you're doing it for the polar bear, you're doing it for the tree or whatever. But like, I feel like Palestinians, without even saying it, understand that they are part of nature and incomplete without it. And that's why there's like this deep hole in their souls. I'm saying they are, even though I'm talking to you, about this separation.
And I want to, so you basically just answered this question, but I want to specifically name it because I think I know I make a lot of assumptions sometimes because I was born Palestinian. I can't be born anything else. I can't be anything else. And we both sort of worked in this space for a really long time. So I think telling on myself, it's easy for me to be like, well, yeah, isn't this is so obvious. Like, why don't you know this? Not helpful in trying to call people in to a movement. So I do just want to name. I was going to ask this question about, what do you say to people that say Free Palestine is not part of their struggle? And so you already kind of answered it, but I want to just put a fine point on it because I don't want to assume that anybody just heard what you said and made the connection because that's not a fair assumption.
I especially if those people are claiming that they want a livable future. There is no livable future in which people are occupied. There is no livable future that includes a genocide. And I think a lot of people feel like it's not their problem, one, because they feel like it can't happen to them.
Whew,
I believe it.
yeah.
I absolutely think it could happen to any of us, right? Like those weapons don't only ship to Israel. But I also think that we have our, if you only care about something, if you think it can happen to you, you're morally bankrupt and you need to go work on that. So we should care about Palestine because they're human beings. We should care about Palestine because this is what's happening on our planet, and very much in front of our faces, with our tax dollars. But even if none of those things are true, it all comes back to those are human beings and we should care what happens to them. It kind of reminds me of a James Baldwin quote from the 1950s, no, 1960s, where he says, the South is not merely some backwards parts of, some backwoods area, but it's a part of this country and what happens there concerns every single one of us. And that's how we feel about Palestine. And I think that especially environmentalists who feel like it's not part of our concern. Like I've heard folks say like, oh, that's over there, that's the Middle East. They're always, in conflict. They're always like, there's this weird idea that Arabs are always either suffering or murdering. Like there's no other life. And that, I mean, that's a major failure of the American imagination, and criminally so. But if the Middle East is out of your purview as an environmentalist, girl, where do you think the oil comes from? Like, how is that out of your purview?
Absolutely. And I saw this was a little while ago, but I saw at one of the protests a sign that said Palestinians are peaceful people until the check comes. And I
That is
laughed out
true.
loud because I was like, yeah, but there is, and everything that you just said, none of that's an accident, right? So
Yeah.
like it's the same dehumanization that happens in Latino communities and Black communities, in any otherized community. It is a very intentional dehumanization. So really, back to your first point, it's not unique to Arab countries or Arab people or Palestinians. It's a very intentional, well-funded initiative. And you know, these are the kinds of things that I think we're trying to tackle now and in this moment. And it's such a devastating travesty that we had to get to this moment, because for so many people, this is brand new. But again, trying to call people in, even if it's new. But it kind of leads to the very next question really well, which, and you talked, oh,
I
okay.
just wanted to comment a little bit on, like, kind of brushed over the Palestinians are peaceful until the check comes. I have bruises from going out with you, and the check comes. And Ronnie, all of a sudden, you realize, oh, Ronnie lifts weights. Ronnie can fight and does not fight fair when the check comes. But there's so much more that it's so important to say Palestinians are human beings. And it sucks that that is an important thing to say because there's it's so reduced in the American imagination. I remember recently I told you about this. I went to a Palestinian restaurant here in New Orleans that was just so good. And the waiter, the wait staff, the chef, they were all so incredibly nice to us. And I'm thinking to myself, like, you are actively losing family members. Like, you've lost people. Like, how do you have the capacity to be nice to me right now? But they were so incredibly kind, and it was like, wow, and genuine too, and funny, and the food was really good. So it's just, I would be on the floor,
But
you know?
I feel like that isn't granted. I'm talking about my family and my friends, and but the you know, Arab people are very loving, and there's no str I mean, I remember growing up, there were people in and out of our house constantly who, because that is just the nature. It is very loving and welcoming and inviting, and everyone is family. And you know, and so it's obviously everything that's happening is so devastating, and also it's been happening for a really long time. It's just live and in color, and everybody has a smartphone, and it's like, you know, obviously now exponentially worse, and the US is complicit in funding and facilitating all the things. But I do want to just go back, and you kind of talked about it a little bit already, but just points of entry. It's something that I know we both talk about in many different spaces, and this space is not, again, not unique. People want to get involved, but they don't know where to start. They don't know what to do. It doesn't, it feels scary, maybe in some way. I think that's the right word, right? It feels like scary, like, oh, is this my place? Is this my space? And I will just say, like, taking up space versus lending a hand versus whatever, like, there's differences there. But what do you say to those people who aren't sure where to start, who aren't sure what to do, but they want to help?
You know, I do not pretend to be an expert on this, especially when it comes to Palestine. My advice would be the same advice I would give someone getting into climate change, which is basically figure out what you're good at and then do your best. And I think a lot of times when something is big and scary, and I think climate change is big and scary, so is Palestine, or should I say Israel, is big and scary, and it can kind of feel like I want to find the thing to do, and then I want to do my little piece and get out, right? Like I want to make my donation and I want to get out and not think about it anymore. And you got to break down that part of yourself because this is going to have to be a commitment and not just an action. And by that I mean like you're going to have to iteratively find other things to do, right? So like with environmentalism, it can be like today you're recycling, tomorrow you are calling your senators, so the next day you are participating in a community garden. There can be so many different things to do. And you don't have to limit yourself in that way. But yeah, find what you're good at, because if you're doing something you're not good at, you're going to burn yourself out and it's going to be a terrible experience, right? Like if I were trying to be an organizer, I would fail miserably at that. I am not an organized person at all. I can't even organize my calendar. So me organizing, other people is going to be a disaster. So I don't do that. But me being a writer, that works for me. I'm good at that. I'm passionate about that. But I actually would turn this question back to you because, not calling you old, but you've been Palestinian for a while now.
I heard old, but okay.
Saying that, but how would you
Seasoned.
advise people getting in?
Yeah, I mean, I think I actually quote you all the time, as far as saying, do what are you good at? Do that thing, because everybody's good at something. And I understand. I mean, I feel this way. I've worked in advocacy and politics for a very long time, and those can seem like scary spaces as well. And so, on in I mean, FMEP is a 501c3, so this is not an endorsement of any one person or party, but in campaign worlds, there are all these different activities, right? There's making phone calls, there's knocking on doors, there's like letter writing, there's all these different things. Any one of those things might be scary, right? Like maybe I'm brand new and I don't want to knock on some stranger's door and convince them of something. Like I feel completely uncomfortable with that. I don't, but I'm just saying maybe somebody feels that way. I have opinions. But maybe just like you said, maybe I really enjoy writing and I want to lead a letter writing campaign. Or maybe I want to, tap into my community or my neighborhood and write letters to the editor to my local paper. Or maybe I want to have like a little house party where, I'm bringing people into the fold because I really love to entertain. I mean, even that sounds so silly, but it's real, like all of these things. Or maybe I hate fundraising personally, but maybe I'm a really great fundraiser and I'm going to put a small event together for, some folks who are going to contribute to an entity, an organization that's really putting in the work. So, to your point, again, I'm ripping you off here, but I also, like I said, I quote you. But it's this idea that is so important. There's not just one thing or one way, and if we all try to do the same things, we're not only doing a disservice to ourselves, to your point, we're also doing a disservice to the movement too, because it's not just one thing. Whether we're talking about Palestine or we're talking about anything else, it's not one thing that's going to get us there. So,
I can't tell you how many times I've been, speaking to a group of people and they're like, so we need to, and I'm always talking about storytelling because that's what I do. And they're like, so we need more stories, right? And I'm like, yeah, we need more stories. And they're like, so everybody in this room, write op-eds. I'm like, nope, not the answer. Because
not what I said.
not what I said, oh, we were in this. It was like if all of you happened to be very good at writing letters, then sure, everybody write letters. But it was like a room full of farmers. And I'm like, if all of y'all are writing op-eds, who's growing the food? Like we need you to
Well, and
farm too.
that's the perfect example though too, because even in that space, I say this all the time, and again, I'm digressing a little bit, but I do work in a lot of rural communities. And as I'm talking about climate change specifically, if I say climate change to a lot of farmers, eyes glaze over and it's like, not interested. But if I talk to them about their receding soil levels and the acidity of their soil and their jacked up harvest schedules and all these things, then it's like, I understand. So it's not even just storytelling, it's also meeting people where they are. So if you have a unique perspective, or you come from a certain background or whatever, where you can maybe reach an audience that isn't typical or whatever. So it's a version of storytelling, I guess, but it's also, like I said, it's also just meeting people where they are. So also very important, including when we're talking about Palestine too. I can't, oh, it's really, I feel tired, as so many people do. But this is, that it's true it's true in this space as well. Like we're not going to reach everybody in exactly the same way. And especially as I go back to what I was talking about before, that like this is new for so many people. And so, for some people, going into a 76-year history is not going to be helpful. Maybe eventually we get there, but like that's not necessarily where you need to start. For some people, that is exactly where you need to start. So, it's just to put a bow on it. I feel like, what you say is exactly spot on. Do what you're good at,
And do your
and draw from
best.
your own experience. Don't try to be somebody else, right? Because like our individual lived experiences and reaching people from that perspective, another buzzy buzzword, authentic, but it is like it's authentic and real versus like, I'm going to read the script in front of me and say this thing this way. It's not like how humans work. So, yep. Anyway, I've got to just pivot a little bit. And this is especially fresh right now, just given what happened at UCLA last night, at Columbia University last night, on other campuses as well. I'm angry. I'm really angry. And I feel like President Biden, Mayor Eric Adams, like I have no words for them. The way they've endangered kids is really, really disgusting and atrocious. But I want to get your kind of perspective on what's happening on college campuses right now, not just yesterday and not just with sort of this escalation with police presence and violence, but I want to hear from you, like how do you interpret the protests and the encampments at this time?
I also want to quickly shout out the, student movement here in New Orleans. There's been an encampment at Tulane, which is right across the street from Loyola. So it's a Tulane and Loyola encampment. Some of those kids have been arrested, and all eyes are there to see what's going to happen. University of New Orleans, which people call UNO, also had a walkout. I don't know if they have an encampment yet, but they've done a walkout. And there was an encampment on Jackson Square, which, as far as folks down here know, is the first non-university affiliated encampment, but the police broke that up pretty on the first day. I don't know if folks have gone back, but there's been a lot in the Gulf Coast, which New Orleans has a very strong Palestinian community, so I just wanted to lift that up. But I think, the student movement on college campuses is extraordinarily remarkable, largely because of the Zionist project of controlling discourse at college campuses and making it extremely risky to speak up for Palestine on college campuses. And I think I told you this story once before, but I once almost went out with someone who I found out pretty quickly was like not just a Zionist, but his big contribution to the Zionist project was he came up with a new tactic to shut down pro-Palestine discourse on college campuses. It was wild. So basically, like, I was talking to him on the phone, and he goes, like, I asked what he did for a living. He was like he got kind of his back went up.
Quickly.
And he was like, I work with children at a nonprofit center. And I was like, okay, moved on. At this time, I have a lot of white boys on the internet very mad at me. And I'm like, am I about to get got out here? So I Googled him. And that was when I found out what he did for a living. And that was the fastest ghosting I've ever done in my life. So much money and resources and just man hours have been put into controlling what you can and can't say about Palestine or Israel on college campuses. So to see those, to see those chains break and to break this loudly and this ferociously is amazing. And there is no going back to the status quo after this. Absolutely not. The discussion on Palestine will never, ever, ever be the same after this, because they've always known how important college campuses are. So for them to lose them like this, that is Yeah, that is game changing. And just so proud of these kids on these college campuses who are not backing down at all. But I think it can get dangerous when we start to feel like, look at the next generation, they're going to save us all, right? Because I always have to remind people, Kyle Rittenhouse was Gen Z. Was he still is? He's still alive. And so are all of these kids signing up from all over the world to go be part of the IDF. That's Gen Z too. And so it doesn't do us any good to like just sort of draw this imaginary line at generations and feel like, you know, the kids are all right. No, they're not. If they were all right, they wouldn't be doing this. They wouldn't be getting, you know, the shit kicked out of them by horses, you know? And it's also, it's not just kids out there, right? Some of these folks are in graduate school. They could be my age. Some of them are professors who are getting, you know, beat halfway to death. So it's not, this is not just, there may be a generational shift going on in the ideology, but people said the same thing about the baby boomers, right? Like that can change. And so I think we need to keep having this as an intergenerational conversation and not, it can be very easy to just lay it all on the shoulders of Gen Z and say that they've got it. They don't. They need everybody else's support. And also, it is true that other generations are a part of this as well.
Yeah, and it's one of the thing, honestly, there's so many beautiful, incredible, devastating things that are happening. But one of the moments that really like hit me when the encampment started at Columbia was the 350 professors that self-organized to protect the kids. And, you know, I mean, I'm hoping in a future episode we're going to be talking to James Shamus, who's truly becoming one of my very favorite humans. He's a professor at Columbia, and he helped to organize all those professors too. And it's just, to your point, the intergenerational component. And again, I keep coming back to all movements and all struggles is so important, this one included. It's not, again, to what I previously said, it's not going to be one thing or one generation or one anything that's going to bring us to where we need to get. So, yes, all of that. All of that.
I was talking to someone yesterday about like the okay boomer trope. Like people will say that and then turn around and quote Angela Davis in the next sentence. And it's like, boomer had a birthday. How old do you think Angela Davis is?
Speaking of, she was just on a campus and just,
Exactly.
brought it. So all the flowers to the kids. And by kid, I don't mean that disparagingly. I mean it in a very loving way to the college students, and all the flowers to the professors and the folks that are showing up and lending their platform to further give, not even just give attention, but also to bear witness. I hate to be whatever about it, but to really bear witness, because there's all this propaganda, not surprisingly, that the media ran with to start, that folks kind of ran with, because this is how it's always worked. And so folks with platforms showing up in, like, let's be honest, less than safe situations to lend their platform and also to say, I was there. And this is what I saw, and this is, I just, all of this together, again, all of us together coming together. So sorry, I'm getting lost in this, but I do want to kind of bring us, as we wrap up this conversation, I want to ask you a couple of quick questions. One is really annoying, so I'll just preface with that, but we'll get to that in a second. So first, what are some trusted resources that you like, that you seek out for accurate information on Palestine and other justice issues? So we'll start there, and then I'll ask you the annoying question.
Okay, I can't wait for the annoying question. I so this is an interesting question because I feel like the media has really fractured, and a lot of legacy media has just straight up failed right now. So I was, you know, I often would get my news from like my Apple News app, and I started to notice that I would open it and there would be one story at the very top about Palestine, and everything else is about, did you know that Taylor Swift wears shoes? What? So it's just like I don't trust you anymore. So I download the Al Jazeera app, so I've been following that. I've been following The Intercept, and the Intercepts podcast in particular. For me, sometimes when something feels overwhelming, and sometimes this does, it feels like so much is happening so quickly that like I need to hear it by I need audio. It's harder for me to read because I get distracted. And then Mehdi Hasan just released or just launched his media venture, Zateo. And they've launched a podcast called We're Not Joking. It's Mehdi with Bassem Youssef. And they had a great first episode. So The Guardian seems to be trying to do better. They weren't so great in the first month or two of the genocide, but now they seem like they're getting better. They've in particular been good about drawing the links between climate change and Gaza. So I've appreciated seeing that. But yeah, I vote of no confidence in the New York Times. Washington Post does okay on its editorial board. LA Times does okay on its editorial board. I used to like The Atlantic. The Atlantic has just sorely disappointed me. It's just fallen flat on his face in this moment. And yeah, so that's about it. I'm watching new media now, and seeing it feels like the media industry for a million reasons. But its coverage and treatment of Palestine being definitely one of them is just it's crashing, and I will be interested to see what rises from the ashes of it. The kids at Columbia, the journalism kids at Columbia, have been doing a phenomenal job too, and like feel like a Pulitzer needs to be in their future, which is weird considering they're at Columbia where the Pulitzer is housed, and like I kind of did Pulitzer Hall. I think they're like around there. So anyway, yeah.
No, love it. That was a fantastic list. So yeah, so good. So okay, last to close us out, this annoying question.
Oh, I have one more source that I go to, and that's you.
Oh, well, thank you. I
If something feels
appreciate
fishy, I so everybody just text Rania if something doesn't feel quite right, and she'll tell you. That's how I get around a lot of it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I have a lot of feelings, lots of things. Yes. Okay. So the annoying question, and it is something I hate every time anybody asks me. So I sort of apologize ahead of time, but only sort of. And that is, what is giving you any sense or source for hope? And the
Oh,
reason
gosh.
I'm asking and not asking this question is because truly, maybe more so ever than in ever in my life, feeling hopeful about anything feels like such an act of resistance. That's I don't know how else to say it. It feels like, being hopeful about anything is just, it's my adult form of rebellion. I don't know.
I'm not a very hopeful person, and I gotta be honest, the thing that has made me feel I wouldn't say I'm also hopeless, but the thing that has made me feel most hopeless about climate change has been the world's reaction to Gaza. I feel way less optimistic about a livable future now that I've seen what we do in the face of a very obvious genocide. So that said, though, I feel like I don't have the authority to give up because I see Palestinian children smiling and laughing and playing. And if they can do that, then that doesn't mean I have no right to give up. No right.
Thank you. Thank you. Whew, deep breath. So as we wrap up our conversation, I just cannot thank you enough, Mary, for spending time with me today.
Of course.
Your voice, always a reminder of the part that we all have to play for a free Palestine. It's been so impactful. I've felt such support from you, obviously, from the beginning and continue to. So thank you. And thanks to our listeners for tuning into this episode of Occupied Thoughts. Please make sure to check out the FMEP website. That's www.fmep.org for resources related to this podcast and lots of other great content related to Palestine and Israel. Please make sure you subscribe to this podcast to stay up to date, and you can Find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Spotify. And you can also watch a video version of this podcast, including this one, on YouTube. And with that, I'm Rania Batrice, signing off until the next episode of Occupied Thoughts.